We're doing Parashat Mishpatim. This parasha is loaded. It's got many laws, as the name infers. Parashat Mishpatim, the parasha of laws. And there are whole tractates that are based on verses from this parasha. So obviously we can't cover everything, but we will try to cover a lot. The parasha begins by telling us that we will be covering the laws. The laws that God tells Moshe to place before the Jewish people. We have the laws of a Jewish slave. We have the laws of a Jewish girl who is sold as a servant. We have the laws of what happens if the Jewish slave says, I want to prolong my stay, I want to continue when his 6 years are up. We have the laws of if a person buys a girl as a servant, how he has a mitzvah to marry her, he or his son. That's really the purpose of buying a young female slave for marriage. The Torah then tells us someone else, purposely, with witnessly, then he gets the death penalty. If he does it by mistake, then the Torah teaches us the law of Galut, that God will establish cities of refuge where the person must escape to. If the person we know killed someone willingly, and then he runs to the temple and holds on to the altar and says, no, God save me, I'm here in the holy place, don't touch me. The Torah says, no, we take him, name Mizbechi, we take him from the altar, Mizbechi, we take him from the altar. The person wounds his parents and causes them to bleed and does that on purpose, then he gets the death penalty. If the person kidnaps someone and resells him, he gets the death penalty. If the person curses his parents with God's name, he gets the death penalty. One person is fighting another person and he wounds him, so then the Torah teaches us the laws of damages. How much does one have to pay the other if they... person damages one another. What happens if a person kills their slave? So here we see, amazing, the Torah says that the person gets the death penalty. It's his slave, he bought him. Nonetheless, the Torah says he's not allowed to kill him. If two people are fighting and one mistakenly hits a pregnant woman and she loses the fetus, so again, the Torah enumerates how we evaluate how he has to repay the woman, the family, for the loss that he caused them to incur. If a person hits his slave and causes them to lose an eye or some kind of limb, the slave goes free, no questions asked. What happens if a person's values, his ox, cause damage? A person has a... what? So then again, let's say the ox kills someone, then the Torah teaches us that the ox gets killed. And we cannot derive benefit from its meat. The master must pay the damages. The person digs a pit, causes some stumbling block for people in public domain, and someone gets damaged, he has to pay. If a person's ox kills someone else's ox, so again the Torah describes how we evaluate and how he must pay. What happens if a person steals? So ordinarily we say he has to pay back what he's stolen. If he's caught red-handed, he has to pay back double. And if he steals an ox or a lamb, so for a lamb he must pay 4 times the value of a lamb, and for an ox, 5 times the value, and we'll discuss why as we go over it more in depth. Let's say a person is at home and he sees someone trying to break into his house, and he has to suspect that if this prowler encounters him, he'll kill him. So the Torah allows him to kill the person who's breaking in. What if it's his father? So then the Torah says, you know, a father, even if he's coming to steal from his son, is not going to kill his son. So then one may not defend oneself by killing the prowler.
But what if he doesn't know that it's his father?
He doesn't know. It has to be clear.
Right?
If a father sees his son breaking in, he has to suspect that if he'll try to stop his son might kill him. It teaches us something about how God made us. If a person allows his animal to go into someone else's field and damage, so he has to pay back the damages. Now, you can understand that the Torah is talking in terms that were relevant in their times, and in our times, we apply them according to things in our times. To their flowers, their margolias, whatever it is. What happens if a person is making a barbecue, and the fire gets out of hand, and destroys someone else's property? And the Torah says he has to pay. And here there are many details, which obviously we can't go into everything. What happens if the person gives something to someone else to watch for him? So here, if someone's doing you a favor, for free. He's watching over your object. Obviously, he has very little responsibility. The only thing is, if he was negligent, you gave him your Rolls Royce to watch, and he left it unlocked, and left it in the driveway, and left the windows down, and then it was stolen. So then we say, hey, that was negligence. You didn't do your end. You have to pay up that Rolls Royce. On the other hand, what happens if he was paid for watching it? So then he has more responsibility because he's a shomel sechav. He's watching and he's getting paid for it, so he has more responsibility. So then he's also responsible if it gets stolen. What happens if he rents the object? So then he's getting benefit and the other person is also getting benefit. He's getting paid for it. So that's somewhere in the middle. That's in between shomel sechav and shomel chinam. What happens if a person borrows an object? Those are the four cases where one person would have someone else's object and he's responsible for it. Either he's watching it for free, he's watching it for pay, he's renting it, or he's borrowing it. So if he's borrowing it, then he has the maximum amount of responsibility because he's getting all the benefit out of it. Even then, we say there are things that he's not responsible for. If you lend a person your hammer, and as he's banging a nail into the wall, the hammer falls apart, so they say, well, that's what you lent it to me for. I'm not responsible that the hammer went. Most hammers don't go. I was using it the normal use. So that's called Mita Mahmat Melacha. It passed away while I was doing the normal work with it. So that's what he lent it to me for. What happens if you lend your Picasso? So, and then you come and say, give it back to me. And he says it was stolen. So then the Torah says, we say, you know, maybe it just so happens that this guy wants to hold on to that Picasso. So the Torah says when you give someone something to watch and he claims it was stolen, he has to take a vow that it was indeed stolen, that he's not holding on to it because he wants it and he'd rather pay and hold on to it. What happens if he comes back and says, you know, I borrowed your animal or I was watching your animal and it died, I buried it. Gone. So same thing, the Torah says he has to take a vow that really would happen. What happens if he's caught that he robbed it, that he really stole it? So then he has to pay double. The Torah then goes over to issues of people damaging one another. What happens if a person seduces a little girl? So then the Torah says that he has her if he wants, and he marry her if he wants, and she wants, and her father wants. Otherwise, he has to pay her a tax of 50 silver coins, plus the value of the shame that he caused her, and caused it to incur. Mechashefah, witches and warlocks, those. And the Torah tells us that if a person has relations with an animal, also there's the death penalty. The Torah gives us a general warning: we're not allowed to serve any gods other than God. And this will be repeated many times and repeated many times. That we're not allowed to pray. We have a special mitzvah to be kind to a ger. The same thing with a widow or an orphan. These are people that are weak, in society's ladder. So we have a special mitzvah to protect them. And God says, "These protect them." And God says, "These people call to me. I listen." Because God says, "When you were in Egypt." So, who is fending for you? No one. I fend for the poor. I fend for those who have no one to fend for them. Not because they're the most righteous people, but simply because they're at the bottom of the ladder. God says if one oppresses a widow, so then God says I'll get angry at that person and kill him and cause his wife to be a widow and his children to be orphans. We have a mitzvah to lend money to other Jews, and after we've lent it, not treat them differently. Special mitzvah in the Torah that we shouldn't treat a person like he's a borrower. Someone owes you money, it's time to pay. You feel like every time you're walking by them, hey buddy, what's going on? Torah says no, you have to be kind to the person even though he owes you money. And the Torah forbids us from taking interest. The Torah tells us what happens if we take collateral, and that collateral is his bed, it's his blanket. So we have a mitzvah to return it every night. Every night he needs it to sleep in. So the Torah says, in the morning, come back and collect your collateral. But at night, that's what he needs to sleep in, so give it back to him.
So every day you renew the pledge?
You don't need to renew the pledge, but it'll be a pain in the neck to go back and forth every night and every morning to collect the collateral and bring it back. The Torah forbids us to curse our leaders. Seems like this is an ancient problem. Now I don't know if this would apply to today's leaders. It applies to a dayan, a person who's a judge in a Jewish court, or a person who's a prince, king. Torah tells us that when we have to give our taxes, God tells us that the parts of the crops is we shouldn't detain that. A person shouldn't wait to detain that. A person shouldn't wait till late in the season. We have mitzvah to be holy people, and this applies to what we eat. Holiness applies to the way we have matter or late eat. And that's why they eat non-kosher meat. It has to be kosher. The Torah warns us that we shouldn't take God's name in vain, and we shouldn't be a false witness, and we shouldn't be swayed by public opinion when it comes to taking a vote on what penalty the court should give. By the same token, we can't give extra honor to the poor. We have to judge fairly. That applies all the time. Mitzvah applies all the time. Mitzvah Shavas Aveda. You see someone's object missing, so we have a mitzvah to return that. Lochan Shulchanar. Lochan Shulchanar. You see, I find that people overlook this most commonly when they get misplaced mail. So sometimes you get mail that isn't yours, so people very often will just put it on the mailbox for the mailman, hopefully, to take it, or the wind to take it, or anyone but themselves. And that's a mitzvah Shavas Aveda, that someone's lost object, we have to give it back. But this is relevant all the time. You come across a pen, you come across someone's notebook, you come across someone's book. What happens if you see your enemy? This is a guy who isn't such a righteous Jew, and he harms you, and you see him traveling, and his donkey can't handle the weight, and he needs help unloading the donkey. Torah says we have a special mitzvah to help someone unload the donkey, and this is the source for the mitzvah of Tzar Bali Chaim, that we're not allowed to allow pain, animals to suffer unnecessarily. We have to prevent that. That's a special mitzvah in Torah called Tzar Bali Chaim, pain for live creatures, anything that's alive, that suffers from pain, we have to try and prevent it from having pain. Yeah.
It's also the mitzvah of loading and unloading?
It is also the mitzvah of loading and unloading, right. We have a mitzvah to help someone unload, and if you see two people, so and they both need it equally, so then you should prefer to go to your enemy, because there you're gaining. You're becoming a better person by doing it. You're not only helping the person and the animal. The Torah warns us again against taking bribes, and again not to oppress the ger. Torah then gives us the mitzvah of Shemitah. In the seventh year, we have to let the land go fallow, and whatever grows is free for all. And now the Torah goes into a listing of Shabbos, and Pesach, and Sukkot, and Shavuot, the Yom Tovim, the three times a year when we have to go up to the Beit HaMikdash. And at the end, the Torah tells us that we may not cook meat with milk, which is the source for the prohibition of eating meat. At the end of the parasha, the Torah tells us that God is going to send an angel to guide us and bring us into the land of Israel, and we have to listen to that angel. When we come to the land of Israel, we may not serve the gods that are there. We have to be faithful to God that are there. We have to be God promises us will send a special fly called the Tzira that sends its venom, it spits its venom into people's eyes, and that castrates them and that blinds them. And God promises us he'll send that and help us with that fly to conquer the land of Israel. God forewarns us that the land will not be conquered quickly, because we can't, if we conquer it quickly, then we won't be able to inhabit it at that date. God says, I'll let you conquer it slowly so you could inhabit it, and you won't have a situation where you have the land laying fallow and the houses laying fallow. Slowly we'll conquer the whole land. And we have a warning not to make a treaty with the nations of the land, because they'll cause us to sin, they'll cause us to follow their ways and their gods. God tells Moshe, you come up to Sinai with Aaron and Nadav and Avihu and the 70 elders and bow from a distance. And Moshe will come forth, and this is when Moshe is going to go up for the 40 days and 40 nights. And before Moshe goes up, Moshe builds an altar, and this is when the Jews are going to become Jews. They heard the Ten Commandments not as Jews. Now the gear process is going to take place at the end of our parsha. Moshe teaches them the Torah that's been given thus far. He builds an altar, and he sets up 12 stones corresponding to the 12 tribes. He brings sacrifice, which is part of the gear process. Today, they have that sacrifice, and our sages derive that one can become a gear without it. Really, part of the gear process is that one has to bring a sacrifice. It used to be that when a person would become a gear, one of the things he'd do is set aside When the temple will be built, I'll bring the sacrifice I told. Then our sages said, people ended up having that money lying around, and they ended up doing the wrong things with it. It got mixed up with their other money, and that money has holiness. So they said, don't set aside money. When the temple will be built, you'll get the money for it. But really, in truth, any person that comes to Ger should bring the sacrifice, and will bring the sacrifice when the temple will be built. Moshe took part of the blood and sprinkled the blood on the altar. He read the book of the pact, which is basically the Torah that's been given this far, and the people said the famous line, Nasa v'nishma. Many people err. They think it was in last week's parasha by the Ten Commandments that they said Nasa v'nishma. That is incorrect. They said it here. After the Ten Commandments, it would seem, when Moshe has already been told many of the commandments, now they said Nasa v'nishma. In last week's parasha, they said whatever God says, we'll do. Nasa. And that's the pact. And then the Jews became Jews at this point. Moshe goes up, and he and the elders, Aaron, Nadav, and Avihu, and they get a prophetic vision. It's unclear what they saw. They eat, they drink. And God tells Moshe, come up, and I'll give you all of the Torah, the written law, the oral law, all that the prophets are going to say in the future, the Mishnah, the Gemara, everything you'll get. And Moshe goes up, and he tells the elders, you wait here. Anyone that needs anything should go to my brother Aaron and Hur. He goes up. After 7 days, he goes up to heaven, and the Jews see a vision of a flame on top of the mountain. Moshe is going to be there for 40 days and 40 nights, at the end of which time the Jews will sin with the golden calf, the eagle. That's foreshadowing. That's not this week's parasha. Now let's review the parasha with more depth. Our parasha begins with Ela Mishpatim, these are the laws, and the enumeration of the laws of a slave. And we have three types of slaves. There's a Jewish slave, a Jewish servant. It could be a person deciding, I want to sell myself. Or a person that's caught as a thief, and he doesn't have the money to pay back what he's stolen. So if he can't pay back the principal of what he's stolen, then the courts will sell him as a servant. Now, this concept of a Jewish slave is only relevant when we have Yovel. This is a concept in Halacha, when the Yovel is relevant. What is the Yovel? Yovel is the Jubilee year. When's the Jubilee year relevant? When's the Jubilee year relevant? When the land is divided, and it is on the land to the different tribes. That's also the concept of Yovel, that a non-Jew may say, I accept the Noahide laws, and I'll become a citizen of the people of Israel. I'll be a Ger Toshav, not a Ger Tzedek, but a Ger Toshav. I'll live here. So that's only relevant when the Jews all live here and the land is divided. And then we have the halacha of Yovel. Nowadays, though, we don't have that, so there's no concept of a Jewish slave, and there's no concept of Ger Toshav and other things. When a Jew is sold, so the first thing that no Torah says is the Torah doesn't want him to be sold. It has to be the last straw. It has to be after he has no money. He doesn't even own the shirt on his back. He doesn't have money for food. He doesn't own anything. When he is that poor, he may sell himself, or if he's caught after having stolen something, the courts may sell it. The same thing is true with one's daughter. When the Torah permits one to sell one's daughter, even though the ideal is that she will marry is different, this is the way of marry the person forward in life, nonetheless, the Torah only permits it after the person is so poor that he owns nothing, including the shirt on his back. Only then may he take that step of selling his daughter, and even then, recommended, they viewed it as it landed on a person from heaven, and even then the person has a mitzvah to redeem her, to put together the money to buy her back. Now, when a person is sold as a Jewish slave, so if he sells himself, he may sell himself for an unlimited amount of time. He could sell himself for as many years as he wants. If the courts sell him, so then our parasha says the courts are limited to a sale of up to six years. And those 6 years could include the Shemitah year. Only Yovel, the Jubilee year, Yovel called Yovel, because Yovel is a ram's horn, and the year begins with blowing the ram's horn. So only Yovel slaves, but Shemitah does not. So when the courts sell a person, they are up to 6 years, and then when Yovel shows up, or he puts together enough money to pay back, or his master chooses to free him, and he gives him a document of freedom, or his master dies and has no children, those are the ways he could go free. The Torah gives a special mitzvah when a Jewish slave is sold by the courts, that the master should give him gifts when he leaves. Master should give him sheep, should give him crops. We want him to move up in society. Let's think of their culture. Everything is based on land. And the Torah wants a society in which people make ends meet, they support themselves. So what the Torah instituted was a concept of Shemitah and a concept of Yovel. Shemitah is the year when everyone could eat from the field. And Yovel is the year where all sales return. So you sell your land and the sale is for up to 49 years. At the end of 49 years, the 50th year is Yovel. At that point, all lands go back to their original owner. That's the plan the Torah had. The Jews never kept this properly. But that was what the Torah said we should do. You could understand that it's not easy to keep this. You make a sale, so the Torah says you can never sell land for more than 49 years. You sell it up until the Yovel year. And the Jews, when they entered the land of Israel, did not keep these laws. The prophets yelled at them, and they kept them for a short period, and then they didn't keep them again. But this never really happened. But the idea that the Torah told us what we should do is that after 49 years, the lands go back and all slaves go free. Now, all Jewish slaves go free. Now, that means that when a person goes free, he has the ability to rebuild his life. He gets his house back if he had to sell it. He gets the lot back. He has the ability. So, Yovel is when people go free, and Yovel is really means a horn. Yovel is a ram's horn, which is what was blown, and that was a signal that all slaves go free. When we blow shofar at the end of Yom Kippur, we're doing that in Yovel, when in courts they used to blow shofar at the end of Yom Kippur. That's when it was blown. Yovel, in the Beis Din, they blow shofar. So that's why we blow it every year in commemoration of that. Let's say a person sold himself, so he's a Jew, like every other Jew. Let's say the court sold him, he's a Jew like every other Jew. But if the court sold him, so then he is the master, when he buys him, is permitted to give him a non-Jewish slave and tell him, I want you to bring me children. The master may not tell him night after night, you go to this woman, you go to that woman. He has to single out one non-Jewish servant, and the master may not give one woman to more than one slave. But that one slave may marry a non-Jewish woman, provided that he was sold by the court. Now, the Torah gives us some clauses. The Torah says it must be that person has a wife and family and kids before he may marry a non-Jewish slave. Think about the logic behind it. The Torah doesn't want him to get too attached to this non-Jewish girl. The Torah wants him to go back to his family life and build his family. The Torah forewarns us that he might get attached, and the Torah isn't interested in that. So the Torah says, if he has a wife and he has kids, and he was sold by the courts, meaning he was caught as a thief, so then the master may tell him, I want you to bring me children, that's part of the job you owe me. At the end of his time of service, so if he sold himself, he could have sold himself up to 49 years, until whenever the yovel falls out, and then he goes free. If he was sold by the courts, then the Torah says he has, when his time is up, he's sold for up to 6 years, he could say, I love my master. I love the wife he gave me. I love the kids I had from her. And then the master may take him to the courts, and then they take him by a doorpost, and they pierce the top of his earlobe, the top of his right earlobe. They take a metal awl, and they go to either a door or a doorpost, either a door or rect. It could be anyone that's erect. It could be anyone's door or doorpost. And they pierce the top of the ear. Now, it seems like ivory. We saw the person said that the custom of women wearing earrings goes back to this custom. That initially women wore earrings, it was a sign of subservience to their husbands. That's what we had seen. So it seems like this was an ancient custom that the Torah, so to speak, purified. We find many times the Torah takes certain customs that were around before the Torah was given, and the Torah says, this is how you should do it. So in this case, the Torah says, if this servant that was sold by the court says, I want to continue. Now, I want to continue means I want to continue with this non-Jewish wife, which we'll have to discuss. She's not so non-Jewish, but she is a non-Jewish woman who is a slave. So then the Torah says, the master, he becomes an eved nirza. Nirza means rotzea, is to take an awl and pierce something. This slave whose ear was pierced is called an eved nirza, a slave whose ear was pierced. So the slave says, I want to stay. And we say, no, don't do it. Go back to life. God doesn't want you to live as a slave. You have responsibilities. Go back to your family. And the slave says, no, I love the wife. I love the children. I love my master. So then the master could take him, and the master himself has to pierce his ear. It must be that he loves the master, and the master loves him, that he is healthy, and the master is healthy, that he has a wife and children, and the master has a wife and children. He has to say, I love my master, I love the wife I have here, I love the children, and I love his family, I want to stay with him. In that situation, so then he may stay. Now you'll ask yourself, who would want to do this? So let's review the halachos of how much honor a Jewish servant has to get. The Torah tells us God doesn't want him to be sold as a servant. That's not what God wanted. A person has to have responsibility in life and live up to that responsibility. This is a cop-out. This is a cop-out. This is like welfare. A person can't make it. So there is a social system to help him out, but it's not the way a person is supposed to live his whole life. But for the majority of life, a person is not supposed to live on welfare. A person is not supposed to live in this situation. So hopefully he gets out of it. Firstly, the Torah says when a person is sold, he cannot be sold like a slave on the market. He can't have a stone and stand him up and say, I have a slave for sale. He can't even sell him on the side streets. It has to be done privately. Meaning the courts would go over to people who they thought were candidates, and they'd speak to them one-on-one. Maybe you want to take it. Like a chesed issue, like a project. It wasn't done publicly. The master is not allowed to make him work avodat parech. What is avodat parech? That's backbreaking work. That's work either that he doesn't need it, just says, I got to keep him busy. So he says, okay, plow that field. It's all plowed. He doesn't need it. He says, plow it again. So that's forbidden. You're not even allowed to ask him to heat up water for a tea if you don't plan on drinking tea. If you need the water, you could ask him to heat it. If you don't need it, then that's a biblical prohibition of not making him work avodat parech. And one may not make him work that is endless. Meaning if the master tells him, I want you to dig around this tree, just plow the earth around the tree, that's forbidden. He has to tell him, either plow the earth around this tree for the next 5 minutes, or plow until it's finished. But he can't tell him, you keep plowing until I come back and tell you to stop. That's forbidden. That's called avodat parech. He has to give him work that's necessary and with a finite point. But it gets better. The Torah says that even though he's the slave, the master has to treat him like he's hired help. He's not allowed to make him work any menial jobs. Meaning, he can't tell him, you carry my things behind me while I go to bathe. He can't tell him that when I come home, I want you to take off my shoes. He's not allowed to do that. The servant has to be treated with dignity like hired help. If the person wants him to give him a haircut, he may give him a haircut, but he may not tell him, I want you to now work as a barber for everyone. I want you to now work as the helper in the bathhouse. You'll give everyone their towels. No. Whatever his job was before he became a servant, that's the job he's supposed to maintain as a servant. The master wants him to help him help him personally, giving him a haircut or helping him when he goes to the bath, he could do that. But to give him a menial job, a job like that, that's forbidden. By the way, let's say you hire someone, you tell them, your job, I'm going to pay you now $50 an hour, you come to my house and take off my shoes. That's permitted. Because the Torah over here was concerned, this person feels low as it is. He was sold as a slave. Everyone knows he's a Jewish slave. So here the Torah said we have to protect his dignity. But if a person is hired out for some menial job, his job is going to be to clean up the toilets. So that's what he's going to do all day. His head is in the toilet. So fine. That's for pay. That's fine. That's what the person wants to do. He's entitled to do it. And not only is he entitled to do it, but the Gemara teaches us that one should rather do a dirty job and make ends meet than not do a dirty job and come on to the help of the public. So if a person wants to do that, it's even commendable. He should try to find a better job. But if he doesn't, then better do that than come on to the social system. But a slave, a Jewish servant, the Torah tells us we have to be careful not to give him these menial jobs. The Torah says that the master must equate the slave with himself. If he's sitting down to have steak, he has to offer the servant steak. If he's sitting down to drink old wine, he has to offer the servant old wine. He can't say, you know what, I'm eating steak, you have a hot dog. No, he has to eat the same hot steak as him. He has to have the same wine as him. He has to have the same bed as him. If he has a comfortable bed and an uncomfortable bed, the Torah says the slave gets the comfortable bed and the master gets the uncomfortable one. The master can't say, I'm living in New York City, Midtown Manhattan, and you live out in the Hicks. They have to live in the same area. The master can't say, you live in the city and deal with the pollution and I'm going up to the country for a vacation. When he's in the country, the slave goes to the country. When he's in the city, the slave goes to the city. The master may not sell him to someone else or give him as a gift to someone else. And that's why our sages said if one purchases a Jewish slave, he's really purchasing a master. It's so difficult to maintain these laws. Our sages said, "Kol ha-koneh eved ivri, you purchase a Jewish slave, ki koneh adon la'atzmo, it's a tzmo, it's really purchasing yourself. Sorry, yourself. Sorry. Can you?
Oh, no, you answered my question.
Okay, yeah.
So if you become a slave, you're going to have it better than you had it before.
Except the slavery is really to help the guy out, right? He's going to live in a nicer neighborhood, he's going to have a better bed, he's going to eat good wine and good steak. It was really a chesed project when someone took a slave. At least this is where the Torah wanted it to be. The idea was that this would be a way of getting a person back on his feet. Not only that, when a person is sold as a slave, so then the master is responsible for giving his wife and children to eat. He has to take care of them all the years that he's in slavery. So his wife is being taken care of, his kids are being taken care of, and he's being taken care of. So it is a nice social system. He is obligated to work. Let's say he gets ill, so then it depends. If it's debilitating that he can't work, so we say up to 4 years, still considered like he did his time. Once he hits 4 years, we say he has to do the time over again. If it isn't debilitating, he's got a nasty cold, he's a guy that keeps getting the flu, but when he's in bed, he can make tzitzis, he can tie tzitzis, he could weave, he could sew yarmulkes, knit yarmulkes, so then we say he's doing his time, even though he's not doing the best work he can. Yeah?
What about the family, the slave-setting before he becomes a slave? Is he allowed to visit them for Shabbat and Yom Kippur, for example?
Oh, so the master has to give him time to spend family time, yeah. He does get some time to spend with his wife and kids. Yeah, it's a good question. The master has to treat him like a brother, and nonetheless, the slave has to treat the master, and none the master. To treat the master like a master. Now, this only works if each one is focused on what he's supposed to give, not what he's supposed to get. This is an example that Rav Kellerman, I think, brings as to how marriage has to work. The Gemara says the wife is supposed to treat the husband like a king, and he's supposed to treat her like a queen. Well, if each one is busy telling the other one, "You're supposed to treat me like that," it's not going to work. It only works if each one's focused on what he has to give, not what he's supposed to receive. So here as well, this is really a slave like a brother. And the slave has to treat the master like a master. Slave like a brother. Now, a master only has to take care of his wife if he was to take care of his wife if he was a slave when he became a slave. The guy, you know, life's good over here, so I'm going to go get married. If he wasn't married when he became a slave, he cannot marry a woman and then say, "Okay, now you pay up," unless the master agrees. What about a girl? So long as she's little, let's say her father becomes impoverished, so the Torah gives him a way of selling her as a servant. And the idea here, historically, little girls were sold into prostitution. And we want to see a Jewish girl ending up that way. So the Torah said the father is supposed to take care of her. Let's say the father sees he can't, so he's supposed to marry her off. Let's say he sees he can't do that either, so the Torah says, fine, you have a 3-year-old girl, you have a 2-year-old girl. So, again, a chesed project. What you could do is, a father is entitled to sell that girl as a Jewish servant called an amaizriya, and again, she gets preferential treatment. And not only that, but the master has a mitzvah to marry her, either he or his son. The Torah says, or his son. The Torah says, when this David pointed out, we want her to move up the social ladder. So the person who purchases her, let's say he wants to marry her, he doesn't have to give her a ring of engagement. Because we say the money he purchased her with, that money was really for kiddushin. Because at the time of purchase, it's understood that his job, he has a special mitzvah to marry that girl. The only time that I know of, well, no, it's not the only time, there is another example, when, it's more than one other example. This is but it is one example where a person has a specific mitzvah to marry a specific girl. The master has a specific mitzvah to marry this girl, and if he does, then at the engagement, the kiddushin, he tells her, "You are now my betrothed with the money I gave your father back when I purchased her to do that." The father may only sell her to someone who could marry her. Meaning, let's say one of her brothers is well off. So the father says, I can't support her. I don't have food. I don't have, even the shirt on my back is borrowed. I don't have anything. So now he may sell her. So then he comes to his son, who's well off, and he says, "You want to buy your wife? I sell her to someone else." That's forbidden. Why? Because that son cannot marry her. He's her brother. So the Torah says you have to sell her to someone who will hopefully ultimately marry her. The whole purpose of this sale is that she should get married, and that she should be okay in life. The father may only sell her so long as she's a minor. Once she becomes 12, once she brings two hairs and is an adult, so he may not sell her. Again, he may only sell her up to 6 years, and she goes free just like every other slave, either when she finishes the years, either Yovel comes, she could pay back, or the father could pay back the money that's left over. The master wants to free her and he gives her a contract, you're free. Or if the master passes away and then she goes free, she's not inherited over to the kids. And if she becomes mature, she brings two hairs, she shows that she's reached puberty, she goes scot-free. Regardless, that's a special halacha regarding this girl. Let's say the master says, okay, I want to marry you. Your father gave me the money, so now I'm entitled to marry her. You. She may say no. She's not an object. This is for her benefit. If she doesn't want to, she could say no. Now we're going over to an Eved Kanani, a non-Jew that is purchased as a slave. So, what? Yeah.
Could a Jewish slave or a Jewish man sell his soul, himself and his whole Jewish family to slavery? Because then everybody is working there like much faster out of the shomazo, and he is looking alone.
A person only has ownership over himself. He doesn't have ownership over his wife, he doesn't have ownership over his sons, he doesn't have ownership over his older daughters. The Torah gave him this privilege over his younger daughter, so to protect the girl.
Say, a slave's female male is...
Wait a second, I just want to point something out I forgot to mention, sorry. You reminded me. A mature girl can never be sold into slavery. The Torah protected the woman, even if she stole and she's caught. She robbed the bank. She owes $3 million and she says, I don't have it. I blew it all on the stock market. Bottom line, she cannot be sold as a slave. A woman may never be sold as a slave. Only a man or a girl under the age of 12.
Okay. Say a girl or a man is sold to an unrighteous master. How may he or she protest?
So we'll get to that. It's a good point. We'll get to that. So it's a very good question. The Torah deals with that, not Parsha. So we're going to get to that later, okay? A non-Jew is considered like property. He's called generically Eved Kanani. That's the term for a non-Jewish slave. Now, what happens? How do you get a non-Jewish slave? So if you want to get one today, unfortunately, there's still a slave market out there. Out in Africa, there are a lot of... different religions fighting wars against one another, and then they sell the people they win as slaves. There is a slave market in the world. In Judaism, when a person purchases a non-Jew as a slave, so that can happen in one of a few ways. Either this non-Jew says, I want to be your slave. I'm willing to sell myself. I'll send the money back to my family, and I'll be your slave forever. Me, my family, I can't take care of myself. It's better for me this way, which wasn't uncommon historically. I mean, there were times when people saw that they wouldn't stay alive. Think today. You go into you go down into many places in Africa, the average person is not going to live beyond the age of 30. If he's sold into slavery, he's going to have a much longer and much better life. So it's not something that's so illogical even today. I know it's not politically correct to say that. They caught ones in the United States. There was a big ruckus. They caught a family in Midtown Manhattan. In Midtown Manhattan, that had purchased a servant, a young girl, and she was an illegal immigrant, and she was working in their house, doing the laundry, doing all kinds of household chores. So everyone started terrible it was. And the government said it was terrible, the person in jail. And bottom line, they sent the girl back down to Africa, where she probably she's not living anymore, or she won't live beyond another 10. Did they do this girl any good? Did they really do this girl any good? You know, it's very nice to sit here and yell, you know what, it's not nice to have a slave. Okay, it's much nicer to help people have a better life. We have to also think of what's going on in the world outside of developed countries. There are people that it's to their benefit to be a slave in a developed country rather than live the lives they would in the countries they're in. Yeah. You want something, Jeff?
Oh, yeah. Forever? Can they do certain amount of time?
Oh, so I don't know about that. But I'll tell you what I do know about. I don't know if I think that a non-Jew who wants to sell himself for a year or 2 years, that wouldn't be called selling himself. That would be he's hiring himself out for 2 years. I don't know if he could sell himself for 3 years. Like, I don't know how that works. Let's say there was a war, and one king captured people from the other king. So then the Torah says that if he decides that they're his slaves and he's going to sell them, then we can purchase them and they are considered slaves. The same thing is true if a king says, this country is harming me, and whoever wants to, if you guys want to be bandits, whoever you could capture from this country, you could capture and sell as a slave. So then if they sell that person, so then Torah permits us to purchase that person. These are the general ways in which one can purchase a non-Jewish slave. Now, when we purchase a person, so we tell him, if you're going to be a slave in a Jewish home, you have to become what's called an Eved Kenani, a non-Jewish slave in a Jewish home, which means you will have to become partially Jewish. You'll have to circumcise, and you'll have to accept upon yourself the responsibility to perform mitzvot like a woman. If you want to do it, fine. If you don't want to do it, we'll give you time to think it over. We give him up to 12 months. If at the end of 12 months he says, I don't want to do it, I don't want to accept mitzvot, I don't want to be... I don't want to accept that responsibility, then we sell him on. He cannot stay in a Jewish home. If he wants to stay in a Jewish home, he's given up to 12 months to decide if he wants to circumcise, which is no easy feat. Don't forget, they didn't have such good sedatives back then, and might even be dangerous. And he has to accept the responsibility of performing a mitzvah. Assuming that he does, he becomes an Eved Kenani. So now he has responsibilities like a woman to perform mitzvahs. Yeah?
Up to 12 months.
He has up to 12 months to decide whether or not he wants to do this.
And then do you have time to sell him again?
I think after 12 months you have to sell him.
What if you can't sell him? It takes 3 months to sell
him. I don't know. Now, the master can free the servant, but if he does not, then this person is a slave for his whole life. Him, his children, everything after him, for generations, and he's inherited. How can he go free? If he makes friends with someone who wants to give him money to go free, so then we have a problem. We have a concept in halacha called Yad Eved Ki Yad Rabo. The slave's hand is like the master's hand. Mashekana Eved Kana Rabo. Whatever he purchased is owned by the master. He doesn't have his own identity. He's his servant. So if he acquires something, it's owned by the master. So the way to do it is, a person tells him, I'm giving you this money on condition that your master has no hand in it. He has no right to it. Or he gives it straight to the master and he says, with this money I want to free that person. The master can write him on a contract, you are freed. And the last way he could go out is Allah, the Torah hits him. The Torah didn't want him to do that. So the Torah said, if any one of his limbs, if he loses an ear, you cut off a finger, he goes free. Any one of the 24 revealed limbs, the nose, the ears, the fingers, the toes, any one, if it gets cut off, the slave is freed. The Torah forces the master to write him a contract freeing him.
This isn't the case of Eved Kenani.
Eved Kenani, right.
Is the same hold true for Eved Ivri?
No. Same does not hold true for Eved Ivri. Let's say a master, after the servant accepted mitzvot, says, I'm going to sell you, and he sells him to non-Jews. So now the servant, who's accepted mitzvot, cannot keep Shabbos the way he wanted to. He's subservient to his non-Jewish master. So then there's a tax on the Jewish master that he must repurchase that non-Jewish slave, who's now an Eved Kenani. He must repurchase him for up to 10 times his value, and then free him. And then the slave goes free, because he's not allowed to cause this person to transgress.
That's assuming that he wants to keep Shabbat?
I guess he's obligated to keep Shabbat even if he doesn't want to. And once he goes free, he's obligated to keep all mitzvot. this servant. Let's say the servant, and here's a halacha which is people don't know. Servant tells his master, I want to make aliyah. I want to go to Israel. And the master, so the halacha is that the master aliyah with him, or sell him to someone who makes aliyah. Halacha. Let's say they're living in Israel, and the master says, I want to make yerida. I want to go to Chutzlartz. So he may not, unless the servant agrees. The servant can say, I'm not going. And this is relevant at all times, says the Rambam, even at a time when the land of Israel is owned by non-Jews, even when we don't have possession of the land. Bottom line, there's an important mitzvah to live here in Israel. The servant can say, I want to do that.
Is the servant, if the master is leaving, can the servant, can you tell the servant?
I think so. Should tell him someone else who's staying in Israel. Yeah. When we think of an Eved Kanani, we have to recognize that all the Jewish people have a responsibility to this person to help him. So much so that the halacha says that if a master says, I don't want to feed you, go collecting. He could say that because people will give him food. That's assuming that there's an interesting halacha also that it's his slave. Let's say it's a slave his master brought in, his wife brought into the marriage. Then he can't say that. And we're saying, you have to take care of that slave. I want to end with two things that are important to know. The Rambam writes in the end of the Laws of Avadim, says, you want to work an Eved Kanani, you could make him work. And even though you're entitled to, you own him, you have possession of him, the correct way, the wise way a person is supposed to behave is to be compassionate and always chase after righteousness and not make the servant work hard and not pain the servant. And you should give him to eat and drink from everything he eats and drinks. Our sages, when they would sit down to eat, before they ate, they would give the servant to eat of everything they would eat. And before they drank, they'd give them to eat before they ate and drank. Just as the verse says in Tehillim, Keinei avadim el yad adonihem. Just as a slave looks up to his master, hoping he'll treat him kindly, so do we look up to God. And a Jew is not supposed to disgrace even the non-Jewish servant, not with actions nor with words. The Torah gave him a right to have this person to work for him, not to shame him, not to yell at him, not to be angry at him, but to speak to him kindly and to listen to him when he has complaints. This is something to think about even when it's not our slave, when it's our worker. And this is what Job said about himself, that when my servant, even when he had a claim against me, I would listen up. And the Rambam ends the Laws of Servants. He says, and the traits of achzariyut and azut, which I don't want to translate, are only found by goyim. They are not found by Jews. Whoever is from the offspring of Avram, whoever is of Israel, that God gave him the blessing of the Torah and gave us the right, supposed to be compassionate to all. People sometimes hear about the laws of slaves in Judaism, so they think, oh, Judaism doesn't care about people. This is the way a person is supposed to behave. And these are the traits of God that commanded us to be like Him, to have compassion over all, to have mercy for all, and whoever has compassion for others, God will have compassion for him. So we had a quick overview of the laws of servants. Now let's continue the parsha, because we have 100 things to cover here. Explaining the Ten Commandments. Explains that our parsha is really explaining the Ten Commandments. So the parsha is enumerating what is a person entitled to, what does a person own, and once a person understands that, so he will know what he's permitted to want and what not. The Torah tells us when a slave says, I want to continue after his years are up, and his ear is pierced, he becomes an Eved Mirza, so he is brought forth to the court in order to have that ear pierced. The Torah calls the court Ha-Elokim, gives it the name of Elokim, which is often usually used for God. So one understanding is that they are judging in God's name on earth. God created the world and he wanted that there should be justice in the world. So he gave the responsibility for justice into mankind's hands so that mankind will establish courts which are representative of God in this world. And that's why they are called Elohim. The other understanding is they're called Elohim because we have a tradition that when the courts judge correctly, so then God is with them. They have a special siyata dishmaya. The Torah teaches us if a person hits his non-Jewish servant and causes him to die, he gets killed. He gets killed. This is supposed to. Here there are two understandings. One understanding is the Rambam explains that the Torah is trying to protect the weak people and the person is a slave. So the Torah is warning the master, you be careful. If you pain him, if you harm him, you cause him to lose a limb, he'll go free. You kill him, you will die. The Torah does not allow us to treat people with cruelty. The Sefer HaChinuch says that the idea is differently. The idea is that God didn't want us to be angry people. We're not supposed to yell at people, we're not supposed to hit people. And if a person went so far as to hit his slave in a way that the slave died, the Torah says he lost control so much that he hit the person who was helpless under his hand, he gets killed for that. So that's supposed to give a person perspective as to how he's supposed to treat a slave. And if a person was cruel, so then the courts would intervene and protect the slave, so long as the court saw what was going on. The Torah tells us if a person kills someone else, so then he gets killed. And here we're introduced to the death penalty. And the question is, why does the Torah give the death penalty? Philosophically, there are many opinions as to why we should have the death penalty. One reason that's given over here by the Sefer HaChinuch is that if there would not be the death penalty, people would be killing one another right and left. And that's why the Torah tells us that a murderer who was forewarned, are witnesses, so then he gets killed. And we understand from this Sefer HaChinuch that he understands the concept of the death penalty in the Torah as a deterrent. That's one understanding as to why there should be a death penalty. According to the Rambam, the four different deaths that Beis Din can execute a person with are four separate mitzvot. And according to the Rambam, they're all an extension of the mitzvah to get rid of evil from our midst. Beis Din can kill a person with skila, stoning, which was basically they'd give him some kind of drug, so he was a little out of it. They'd push him off a rooftop, which was more than twice his height, and then throw a huge stone on him. Hopefully he died from that, and if not, other stones. Sreifa, which literally means burning, but really it was that they pour molten lead down a person's throat. Hereg, which was killing with the sword. And chenek, which was, I guess it's called strangulation. They put the person in zevel up to his shoulders, and then two people would take a string on two sides and pull. Now, who are these? The people who execute are always the people, are usually the people who testify against him. If they're so convinced that he really did this, and he really was forewarned and was told, if you do this, you will get killed with such and such a punishment, and this is where it says in the Torah it may not happen, and he still did it, which is the only time a person would get executed, they have to fulfill the execution. Now, you understand that this was very uncommon, that a person would get executed. What person would do a sin when he has two witnesses standing there and they're telling him, don't do this, and if you do this, you will get killed, and this is how the courts will kill you, with the following death, and the source for doing this is in the Torah, and then he will do that sin within 3 seconds of having that warning. He has to do it tochi deidibur. It's not common. The Gemara, according to one on the Mishnah, says that a court that would kill a person once in 70 years was called the murderous court. This didn't happen frequently, but the deterrent is still there. You tell a person, if you do this, you can get molten lead poured down your throat, you're going to be killed. It does do something. What? Masechet Makot, right. So Mishnah Masechet Makot, right. Now here, the Torah tells us that a person who kills someone else gets killed a quick death, a relatively quick death, because when you try to kill someone, usually you try to do it quickly so the person doesn't get back at you. So the Torah's punishments are always midah keneged midah. So the Torah pays back a person according to his actions. So this person tried to kill someone quickly, so he gets killed quickly. But let's say a person went and had relations with his sister or with anyone else that he's forbidden to have relations. And there were two witnesses standing there, and they said, don't do it. If you do it, you'll get killed with this and this, that. And he said, I don't care, and he did it right away. So then he gets killed. So then the death is one of the slower deaths, because his sin was a slower sin. It wasn't 1 second. When someone tries to kill someone, they shoot a gun. They do it with a sword. They do it in a way that'll be quickly. So the sin was a quick sin, so the death is a quick death. When a person does sins that are slower sins, so then the deaths are slower deaths. The Torah tells us if, let's say a person purchases a little girl as an amai zliya, a Jewish servant, and then he wants to marry her. So the Torah says he has to give her equal treatment like any other wife. And here the Torah reveals to us what every husband owes his wife. It doesn't say it anywhere else. The Torah says he owes her, he has to give this little girl, she'irat susav onata. He has to give her like anyone else. And this is the source for what a husband owes his wife. He has to give her a stipend, he has to give her clothing, he has to spend time with her, he has to have marital relations with her. The responsibilities of a husband to his wife are derived from here, from the fact that the Torah says that the female servant, the girl that he purchases, he owes that to. The Torah tells us if a person hits a parent and causes him to bleed, he gets a death penalty. Now, this is the reason why ideally a person should not be his parent's surgeon or his parent's dentist, because inevitably when one is giving medical treatments of this nature, they will cause the person to bleed. Now, any bleeding that is necessary, that's not included in this prohibition. But it is almost impossible to deal with the person medically and not cause a little bit of bleeding that is unnecessary. And for that bleeding, one has transgressed the biblical transgression. So if one can, one should get a different doctor to take care of his own parents. If he cannot, so he'll have to take care of them and do it in the best way that he can, and that he does it right. Right. It's not that he'll get the death penalty if he doesn't, but it is a sin nonetheless, and we try to avoid it. When I was a kid, so what we were told is that doctors try to make a deal with other Jewish doctors, I'll take care of your parents, you take care of my parents. And that's a gamble. You hope that your parents will be healthy, but you hope his parents will be healthy too, right? The Torah tells us one may not curse his parents, and if he does, so then he gets a death penalty. Now this refers to cursing them with God's name, and this teaches us why was the Torah so stringent. If one wounds a parent, so he gets a more lenient death, he gets chenek. If one curses a parent, he gets a more stringent death of stoning. So the reason is because when a person gets angry, it's more common that he'll curse his parents, he'll curse God, than that he'll get up and actually strike a parent. So the Torah gave a harsher punishment to give a greater deterrent, so that a person won't come to cursing his parents. We are forbidden to cause our parents any shame, even shame by inference. A person can't hear something his parents said and say, yeah, right. That's disgracing. That's degrading. One may not degrade his parents even by inference, even by giving a look. Yeah?
Practical example, what about like in a place like this where a lot of us are about children and your parents aren't necessarily the most religious? Like how do you, and they're like, I don't know, people ask like, do you come from a religious home? Like what do you
The question is if there isn't a way of getting out of it cleanly, even without the question of their being your parents. Why should you speak badly about someone? Why is it relevant? If it's just a question of by the way, so you could say, well, ani mitchazek. That's a nice way of saying it. I'm trying to move forward. And then you don't have to get into details where they are. A person should always try to find a way of speaking positively about people. It's one of the things I think people should notice on dates. How does the other person speak about their family members? A positive person, and a Torah person, should be accustomed to speaking about everyone positively. About any person you know, you'll be able to find negative things to say. And the trick is to find the positive. Yeah?
I have a question.
Okay, if you remember, so let me know. Here, we have another interesting halacha. The Torah says that a parent may not strike his big son because when a kid is a teenager, when a kid reaches a certain age or a certain size, there's a great likelihood that you hit him, he'll hit you back. So the Gemara records that Rebbe's servant was once walking in the marketplace and she saw a man strike his big son. So she said, "You're in halachic ostracism. You're in cheren." So he said, "What? You putting me in harem?" So the court said, "She's right. You're forbidden to strike your big son because if you strike him, he may hit you back." Now here there's a long discussion. What does it mean, your big son? Does it mean once he hits bar mitzvah age? Does it mean once he's bigger than you? Does it mean once he hits the age of 21, 23? Well, how do you judge a big son? And all of these opinions are quoted. There are different opinions in the halacha. What does it mean, your big son? But at any rate, the second a parent thinks the kid might hit him back, he may not hit him. And this applies to other things as well. We say you shouldn't say something positive about a person in front of people who hate him, because you say the positive, they'll say, yeah, but you know what? And they'll say all the negative. We're not allowed to cause other people to sin. The Torah tells us that when two people are fighting, so if one harms the other, he has to pay. And here it's broken down into five categories. Nezek, the damages. Tsar, the pain. Sheves, the unemployment time. Ripui, the medical bills. And Boshes, the shame. The Torah breaks it down to these five payments. How do we evaluate it? Nezek, we say, let's say, how much was this person worth beforehand on the slave market? What was his value? If he was a computer programmer and he could make $1 million a year, and now you cut off both his hands, he won't be able to do that. So you made him, now he could only work as a receptionist. So now he can make only $10,000 a year. So you made him lose $990,000. So that you have to pay him. That's the damage. That's how we evaluate the damage. Tsar, the pain. So we evaluate if a person were told that he would have to undergo this procedure, and the executioner tells him, you know, before I give you this procedure, I could give you a shot that you won't feel it. But the shot's going to cost you $30,000. So what's the top price that a person would be willing to pay in order to avoid having this pain? How much would a person pay for the Novocaine? So we say there is a limit. That's how we evaluate tsar, the pain. Sheves, person's unemployment time. So you have to pay him the unemployment time. Ripui, the medical bills. Let's say you tell him, I'll get you a free doctor. So the halacha says, doctors, you get what you pay for. The guy could say, no, I don't want a free doctor. I want a doctor you pay, and you have to pay the medical bills. And Boshes is the shame, so then it depends. Who is the one who did the shaming, and who is the one that got shamed? That's why when the Torah says that if a person seduces a young girl and has relations with her, he has to pay the family a flat rate of 50 silver coins if he's not going to marry her, that's not including her shame. That doesn't include the other aspects of the damages that he did to her. That's first the tax that we say, you got something out of this girl. If you'd go and hire a girl for the same thing, you'd have to pay for what you got out of it. So that's the payment for the pleasure a person derives from the girl. Other than that, he has to pay the damages. That's a separate evaluation. That's why it's a flat rate. The Torah teaches us Adam Muad Le'olam. A person is always responsible for his actions. A person can't say, oh, I didn't see, I didn't know. You're responsible for your actions. If a person damages someone else, he must pay. If a person is in his own property and he's waving around the string with a brick at the end of it, and someone else walks in and gets the brick in his face, so we say, who let you walk into my property? There's a difference between where the damage was incurred. In general, we say that a person has to be responsible for his actions, not to cause someone else damage. And if a person did damages in someone else's property, so we say he's even more responsible. Then even if he can't say, I couldn't help it. I slipped and I bashed your vase. Okay, who told you to come onto my property? There are exceptions. We say if he was climbing a ladder that was a good ladder, and then he couldn't have known it, he couldn't have helped it, and one of the rungs went on him, and then he fell in damage, so then we say because he checked out the ladder, it was a good ladder, and everything was okay, then we say he's not responsible. That's called onis gamul. Completely, it was out of my hands. There's nothing I could do. A wind comes and a tornado comes and thrusts the person across his yard and into someone else's window. He doesn't have to pay for that window. We say he could not have controlled it. There is a point at which we say he's not responsible. What about a person's property? A person's property may not damage someone else's property. We have to watch our property so it doesn't damage someone else. Now, this doesn't only apply to our property. This also applies to our actions. A person starts making a bonfire, and then a wind comes and blows it out of control, and it burns down someone's house. So we say he's responsible for that. He can't say, well, I made this fire here, and the fire went there. Person shoots a bullet and then it goes and does damage. You say your actions, even the force that you bring into the world, you're responsible for. And it's amazing how far the Gemara breaks it down. You have Gemaras that discuss what happens when you shoot an arrow. So you shoot it up. Now there are two forces acting on the arrow. The Gemara discusses the forces. The force moving it forward, the force moving it up, and then the force pulling it down when it goes back down. And again, the force moving it forward. So how much of that do we say is your force? How much of that isn't your force? The Gemara, these Gemaras break down all of these topics to the nitty-gritty. You have the Gemara in their time already was breaking down the laws. How far does a person's responsibility goes as far as his actions, as far as his strength, as far as his as far as his money, his object. The Torah teaches us we're responsible for a pit we dig in public domain, and this applies not only for a pit. People sometimes walk by and see a spill on the floor. People could slip on it. Very often, I walk down steps, I hit the bottom of the steps, and you see there's a little bit of water there. Why is that? Because people are taking down their coffee down the steps. And when they hit the bottom step, very often people spill some of their coffee or their hot water. Now, if someone else is running down the steps, they could slip on that. The Torah tells us we're responsible to clean that up, even though we didn't make the mess. Make the mess. If we see some people, we damage other people, we're responsible to clear that damage. Yeah?
My brother sent me an email about all these court cases in America where, for instance, this one lady was arguing with her boyfriend, threw a soda at him, and then 15 minutes later she got really mad and she ran over and she walked away and she slipped on the ice and sued the place she was at and made $1 million.
So the Torah doesn't say that much. There are ways of evaluating it, but the Torah does say that a person has to prevent. When a person sees things that could damage other people, he cannot make things in public domain that will be damaging. Meaning sometimes people will be in a public place and they'll put down their knapsack. And if it's crowded, people won't necessarily see that knapsack. If you're at a simcha, so everyone's dancing around the chasen, so sometimes people want to bring him a drink. And as they bring him the drink, they spill a little bit of the drink. So I can tell you, more than once I've slipped on as you're dancing, you're running around, more than once I've slipped on that little bit of water that's on the floor. So it's very nice. I very often bring a drink to the chasen, but I always do it with a towel over my shoulder, with one of the napkins, so that if I spill on the way, I'll clean it. I'm responsible for that. If a person breaks a tooth, if a person hits his head, you did that damage. A person came to public domain and caused a spill. So you could say, well, it's the guy who pushed me and caused the water to spill. That's something that the courts would have to discuss. I don't know how it works. But bottom line, we're responsible to get rid of damages in public domain. The Torah teaches us, what about damages that you couldn't really expect? A person's ox was walking through public domain. That's normal. And suddenly decided to gore someone. So then we say he has to pay half the damage and the ox gets killed. And this teaches us an important concept in halacha, that when something causes, even an animal, causes damage to someone spiritually, it caused the death of someone. So we say the source of sin is also hated. Meaning let's say a woman takes an animal and has relations with the animal. So the woman gets killed and the animal gets killed. Because we say that animal was used for sin. When something is the source of sin, so the Torah says you have to get rid of that as well. And no one may benefit from that animal. You're not allowed to eat the meat. Now, this is also a deterrent. An animal is worth a lot of money. If a person knows that if his ox gores someone, the ox is going to be put to death and he won't even be able to enjoy the meat or the hide or anything, it all gets buried, that's a deterrent. Let's say the animal gores a slave, so also the master has to pay. What happens if a person steals? So person steals, he has to pay back what he's stolen. The Torah wants to put an added deterrent, so the Torah says if he's caught, he has to pay double. Now that's a knas. Any time that the Torah forces us to pay something that really logic wouldn't dictate, it's something that according to logic, I stole this amount, let me pay back that amount. So then we say that's a knas. And we have a rule when it comes to knas, modeh b'knas patu. If you admit to a tax, you're patu. So let's say a person comes into court and he says, I stole it. Before they catch him, before we bring the witnesses, so then he's modeh b'knas, he admits the tax, he won't have to pay the double. He'll only have to pay the principal value of what he stole. This is also relevant to the slave. If you recall, we said a non-Jewish slave, if the master causes him to lose a limb, he goes free. That's a knas. The Torah instituted a knas. The person caused him to lose a limb, the slave goes free. So what happens if the master knocks out the slave's eye, and the master comes into court and says, I did it. So he's modeh, he admitted to the tax, and the slave won't go free unless there are witnesses there. If witnesses can come in and say he did it, and then he didn't admit to the tax, the witnesses walked in and they testified, then the slave will go free. But I don't remember that. I think that's a Gemara. I don't remember what the Gemara's conclusion is. I don't remember. Yeah, sorry.
If a thief steals money, which I wanted to make a business with, And during the time it was stolen, I couldn't make my business and I had a financial loss out of it. And then the thief comes and says, okay, I stole it. And he just has to pay me back the original amount of money or also what I lost because of him taking the money.
So I don't know the answer to your question, but I just want to mention that there the concept of what you're saying is discussed in halacha. There are two concepts that can be applied to the case you're giving. I don't know which one is applied. One is, let's say a person takes a loan for 30 days, and then he brings false witnesses, and they say he took the loan for a year. So I borrowed $1 million for 30 days. You can make a lot of interest in a year on $1 million. So the halacha says that in certain circumstances, we're going to make those false witnesses pay the amount of the value of having that $1 million in your hand for the difference of time. Meaning, when I was supposed to get it back at the end of the month, and instead I had to wait till the end of the year to get it back, like you said, I lost money. I could have made money on that money. So then the halacha does take that into account. There is another case where, let's say, one person steals another person's chametz. And then Pesach comes, and the chametz I can no longer derive benefit from. He doesn't get rid of the chametz. So then there's a concept in halacha that he could say, Harei shelcha lefanecha. This is what I stole, here it is, it's yours. Now it's worthless, I can't do anything with it. There's still a concept that sometimes a person can say, Harei shelcha lefanecha. I don't know how we deal with that. It's a good question, I don't know. Another thing to think about, this is the Torah. The Torah tells us we are not allowed to damage someone, and if we damage someone, we're obligated to pay. How do we understand that? Meaning, let's say we're both driving, and two people are driving, and Reuven's car rams into Shimon's house, and he destroys Shimon's garage. Shimon has insurance on the house. So the insurance is going to pay off Shimon's insurance, not my car insurance. His insurance is going to pay the rebuilding of his house. Do I still have to pay? He's getting the money he lost. But what? But I'm not paying it to him. I'm not paying it to him. I damaged him $30,000. I have to pay him those $30,000. The way I explained it, Son, is that let's say I have insurance on my house. What I'm doing is I'm betting against the insurance company. I'm paying them $1,000 a year, and we're making a bet. If no damage will happen, they can keep those $1,000. If some damage happens, then I get $30,000 to fix that garage. That has nothing to do with the damage that he caused me. He caused me $30,000 worth of damage. He has to pay me, so it could be I'll end up getting paid double. He owes me for what he damaged me, and I'm going to make good on that bet. Let's say I made a bet with someone that morning. Someone's going to crash into my garage today. And if someone crashes into my garage, you give me $30,000. And then he crashes into my garage. No one would say that he doesn't have to pay that damage. That's an external bet. So I think that the logical view is that insurance is the same thing. We're making a bet. We're gambling. I'm saying I'll pay you X amount of money so that if I get damaged, you'll pay it. Not everyone agrees that this is the way it's viewed, but this is what seems logical to me. Sorry.
What about when I have the damage by somebody and somebody says, I don't have the money to pay. Like, no problem, I'm a rich guy and I can pay it, it's no problem for me.
So you forewent the money, fine. You could forego the money. You could always do mesila.
I don't have to
take You don't have to take a person to court. You could free a person of his debt to you. Yeah. Let's continue the parsha. It's a good question. We are supposed to take out insurance. Yes,
okay.
That's what you're asking. Yeah. Not only are we supposed to take out insurance, but I know that there are poskim who said in the United States, not here in Israel, in the United States, if there's a person who cannot afford medical insurance, that you may collect money for that person so he should have medical insurance. Because if anyone knows how it works in the United States, if you don't have medical insurance, you can't really get medical treatment. It's very, very expensive. So there have been rabbis who have said, and I don't know of anyone that contests this, that if a person can't afford medical insurance, he's considered a pauper. You're allowed to collect money for that. That's not called an amenity. That's called one of life's necessities today, having medical insurance. Yeah?
I have two questions. One was, I'm still a little funny, and I'm sure you'll ask about the female slave sold into slavery when she's young. She sold the baby with the assumption that she's going to be married to the purchaser of her.
Either the purchaser will marry this girl or his son.
Or his son. However, when she reaches the age of maturity, then she has a choice if she will indeed marry or not. Yeah?
No. When she reaches the age of maturity, she goes free. Meaning if he did not marry her, she
okay.
goes free.
So they're supposed to be married already before she reaches the age of maturity.
Correct.
Right? And if not, then she goes free.
Correct.
Okay. Second question then. We've established that the owner of the bull that injured another party is responsible for half the damage that the bull incurred. If the bull was not established to be goring or beforehand, only if the bull was not established to be a damaging bull beforehand is he liable for half the damage.
Right.
If the bull is a goring bull beforehand, then it's known.
Then he's liable for all the damage, right? But that's not common because one. Okay, yeah, with you, yeah.
But if he kills another person, then I thought he's liable for death.
He is.
If it's established beforehand that the animal is.
Well, so the Gemara discusses how could you have a bull that gores more than once, that kills more than once. The Gemara says it's talking about a case where it escaped. I mean, he was on his way to being put to sleep and escaped. The Torah tells us if a person steals sheep or cattle, an ox, from someone else, and then he's caught, he's taxed, he has to pay four times the sheep and five times the ox. So the regular understanding that your kids are going to come home with, that Rashi brings, is that when a person steals a sheep, so then he had to go through some trouble. He was embarrassed. He walked through public domain and the sheep rug wiggles around and he carried it on his shoulder. So that's why he has to pay a little bit less than the ox. The Rambam brings an interesting understanding to this. The Rambam says that there was a social problem. People had sheep, people had cattle, people were shepherds. And it was very common that people were stealing sheep and cattle from one another, and it was very difficult to protect oneself from this thievery, and this is the case today as well. And the damage that people incurred when their sheep or cattle was stolen was very great. So because this was a common malady, the Torah gave a very heavy tax to anyone that does steal, a heavy punishment as a deterrent. And that's why the sheep, the Torah said, you have to pay double what you'd pay for anything else you stole. Ordinarily you pay double, so here you pay double the double, meaning you pay four times. And that's, a sheep is relatively easy to steal and then slaughter or resell. But when it comes to cattle, it's even easier, because what was common in those days was that people would let their cattle go out and graze freely. So no one's watching the cattle, it's very easy to steal someone else's ox. That's why the Torah said you have to pay one more, five times the ox. The Torah tells us, "Mechashefa lo tchaye." We may not let a witch remain alive. Now, what's a witch? You know the story about the mean boss who came to one of her workers and said, I want you to have my car ready, I'm going out in a minute. And the worker said, sure ma'am, came back with a broom. At any rate, okay. What's a witch? Back to the Pasha.
She's an indoor in her teller in the future.
The Sefer HaChinuch gives us an insight into understanding what is kishuf. Mechashefa comes from the word kishuf, right? So the Sefer HaChinuch writes as follows. It says, I can't find it now. It says like this. It says, we have a medrash that says that there is no blade of grass growing in this world that does not have a corresponding malach in heaven that tells it grow. Meaning even the regular things that we see in nature are being guided by heavenly forces. And These heavenly forces aren't just angels that stand there and say, crow, crow, crow. They give certain amounts, they impart strength to the world. They give the strength to grow. And the...
only a power decree.
They have the ability to give certain forces into the world. God set them up. Right. God set them up that each one corresponds to something else in nature. But at the same time, God also set up the world in a way that if one knows Kishuv, one can intervene between the angel, the force that's telling it to grow, and guide that force to other things. And when one takes those forces and guides them to something that's bad, so that's called Kishuv. Notice, if one takes those forces and uses it for healing, that's not Kishuv. We said that things that are used for healing, they say if you have a person that's falling asleep, can't stay up, you take the tooth of a live fox or wolf, shual, that's a fox. You take the tooth of a live fox and he hangs it around his neck, and that'll help him stay awake. He won't be sleepy. You have a person who can't sleep at night, so the Gemara says you take the tooth of a dead fox, and that'll help him get sleepy and go to sleep. How does that work? I don't know. Does it work? I also don't know. One try, doesn't it? I don't know if you should really try. But what? The question is, did they also have to have all kinds of incantations surrounding these things? Did you have to know how to do it? When to pull it out? The Gemara doesn't always give us all the details. But things that were used for medicine, so there, if it really works, and we can verify medically that it works, so it would be okay. Some rabbis today are against a lot of the herbal treatments, a lot of the alternative medicine, because they say it's really based in witchcraft. It's not; it has nothing to do with science.
That's not true.
I didn't say everyone. It's good stuff. So that's how Sefer HaChinuch explains Mechashefa. The Rambam explains that one of the main goals of the Torah is to remove Avodah Zarah from the world and all the roots of Avodah Zarah. And the Mechashef, a warlock, is really someone who's doing idol worship in a weird fashion. And primarily it was women doing it, and usually men would have extra compassion, don't kill a woman, don't kill a woman. And that's why the Torah describes it with relation to a woman. But really, it's relevant to everyone. Officially our time is over. I would like to end with one thing. The parsha ends with the mitzvah of Shabbos and the three Yom Tovim. I want to end with an insight into those. Whoever wants to go can go. I was told last staff meeting that was the conclusion that when class ends, whoever wants can go. So whoever wants can go. We have the mitzvah of Shabbos. The Torah reminds us of this mitzvah, and we know that Shabbos, one of the things the Torah tells us is it's a remembrance to the fact that God created the world. There was no world, God created the world, and when we rest on Shabbos, that's what we're attesting to. This world was created by God and he rested on the seventh day. But there's also a logic behind it. People need to rest. Doesn't matter how big, how little, people do need to rest. And if you think about it, what I'm saying now is the Rambam in Mor Nevuchim. If you think about it, says the Rambam, with the Torah instituting a mitzvah of Shabbos, comes out that we get to spend 1/7 of our life enjoying, just having a good time. That's the idea of Shabbos. You take one day out of 7 and you rest. You have a mitzvah to enjoy the Shabbos. You have a mitzvah that every good food that you see in the market, anything you could buy that will enhance the Shabbos, if you could afford it, purchase it in honor of Shabbos. So says the Rambam, comes out, you spend 1/7 of your life having a good time. That's balanced. We need it, and the Torah gives us that mitzvah. When it comes to the Yom Tovim, we have Pesach, Shavuot, Sukkot. So the Torah gave us a mitzvah at these times to be happy and to get together with our family and strengthen our social ties with our neighbors. We invite people, we visit people, we strengthen our ties. And the Torah gave us a mitzvah on Pesach for a week. We have a Yom Tov. True, we have 5 days in between, Shachol HaMoed. Well, the Rambam explains that our life breaks down into days, weeks, months, and years, right? So what was logical when it came to this Yom Tov is to give the Yom Tov a week, not a day. Because God gave us a mitzvah to do something different, to eat matzah. You eat matzah for a day, that's not recognizable. Sure, there are days when I don't eat bread, I just eat crackers. So if I just eat matzah one day a year, that's not a real sign. And therefore the Torah gave us a week as a remembrance for our leaving Mitzrayim, that we should always remember the time that we were in suffering. We were slaves once. And this reminds us to have appreciation for the good that God gives us now. And this reminds us to be humble people. So we eat matzah and maror on the Seder night. We remind ourselves, I wasn't always in this situation. So the Yom Tov of Pesach, says the Rambam, is a reminder that we were once slaves in Egypt. And it's a reminder that we should be humble, we should appreciate what we have, and remember that we were once slaves in Egypt. The Yom Tov of Shavuos comes after we count 49 days, and it's a one-day holiday, because really what happens, it's like when you're anticipating to get together with someone. You guys will see, when you're married, God willing, so part of the laws of family purity is that once the woman ends her onset, she has 7 days of purity. And she's supposed to count, today's day number one of my cleanliness, today's day number two, and she's counting the days of purity, but really she's also counting to the time that the couple could get back together again. And that's logical. I mean, many guys, when they're engaged, like a week or 10 days before they get married, they give their wife either 10 roses, or they give her something like that signifies countdown. So we're also counting up to this special day we got together with God. God came down to us on Mount Sinai. It was like our wedding day. And so we're counting up to that 49 days. And then that one day when God appeared to us was a one-day event. We celebrate with a one-day of Shavuot. Sukkot is a mitzvah to be happy. Sukkot is the time that people finished, they've reaped their crops, they've gathered it all in, they can rest. That's the time God gave us a Yom Tov on Sukkot, v'samachta b'chagecha, to rejoice, to be happy, 7 days. And again, 7 days are, we recognize it's something exceptional. We go out and sit in the sukkah on a time when it's not the middle of the summer, it's not the middle of the winter, the summer is just ending, the winter isn't yet beginning, and we could enjoy it. And this is supposed to be a remembrance for the miracles that were in the desert. We went throughout the desert and God protected us. How could a people, 2 million people, traverse a desert with, where are they getting food from? Who's helping them out? So we say, yeah, God helped us out. We live in a sukkah. We go out of our regular domain like people who go out to a desert. That's what we're doing when we go out to the sukkah. We're sitting in some little hut and we're remembering that this is what life was like before we merited to have the Holy Land. Before we got Eretz Yisrael, we were out, we were wandering, we were living in huts, we didn't have permanence. Then we got the land of Israel. So, in order to appreciate the land of Israel, we have the holiday of Sukkot. Pesach is to appreciate leaving Egypt, that we were once slaves. Sukkot is to appreciate the land of Israel, that we made it here, we have permanence, we have a home. So we go out of our home one day, 7 days a year, and we appreciate that we were given the most fertile land, the greatest land in the world. We were given free homes. We came, we found the land with homes because God made a promise to our forefathers because they served Him faithfully. And then we come to the last day. After 7 days of Sukkot, we hit Shmini Atzeres. Shmini Atzeres, we all go back home and we just rejoice. There's no mitzvah connected to Shmini Atzeres. It's a new concept. It's only a few thousand years that we have Simchas Torah on Shmini Atzeres. The Torah doesn't say that. The Torah says, Shmini Atzeres, just be happy. The idea of Shmini Atzeres is that we take one day when we're back home, we're having our regular food, we're not eating matzah, we're not sitting in a sukkah, we're just saying thank you, God, for normalcy. This is the life you gave us. We appreciate it. You gave us the land of Israel, you took us out of Egypt, you gave us everything we have. Shmini Atzeres is a day just to thank Hashem, just to rejoice. Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.